From New York, this is Democracy Now!
But I do want to make a point about how this is an international crisis and one that where the hunger in the United States is bad, the hunger outside the United States is worse, and the hunger outside the United States is because of U.S. policy, of U.S. trade policy, of U.S. policy around intellectual property rights, for example, at the World Trade Organization.
With hunger growing across the globe during the pandemic, the United Nations is holding a major food systems summit today. But the UN is coming under intense criticism for giving corporations an outsized role in the summit. We'll speak with Raj Patel, author of Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World's Food System, and we'll go to India and Ethiopia. Then the United States of War. We look at the new military partnership between the United States, Australia, and Britain. The U.S. is selling a fleet of nuclear-powered submarines to the tune of billions of dollars to Australia and expanding its military footprint there. Is President Biden provoking a Cold War with China? We'll speak with David Vine about the global history of America's endless conflicts from Columbus to the Islamic State.
The United States currently has about 800 military bases in around 80 foreign countries and territories. And this is more bases than any nation in world history.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Joe Biden said Wednesday the United States will donate an additional 500 million Pfizer vaccine doses to other nations around the world. Biden made the pledge during a virtual global vaccine summit of world leaders.
And it brings our total commitment to donated vaccines to over 1.1 billion vaccines to be donated. Put another way, for every one shot we've administered to date in America, we have now committed to do three shots to the rest of the world.
President Biden called on wealthy nations to vaccinate 70% of the world's 8 billion people within the next year. Critics say Biden's commitments fall far short of what's needed. The vaccine summit's goals make no mention of a push led by India and South Africa to waive intellectual property rights on vaccines and to force pharmaceutical companies to transfer technology to vaccine makers in the Global South. In a statement, the director of Public Citizens Access to Medicines Program said, quote, "Ending the pandemic is a choice. Leaders at today's summit have yet to make that choice. The White House still has not mobilized all its resources to expand vaccine manufacturing and protect millions more lives that may be lost," Public Citizen said. The United States reported nearly 2,800 COVID-19 deaths Wednesday, more than a quarter of the worldwide death toll for the day. In Washington, D.C., the Food and Drug Administration's approved third-dose booster shots of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine for people age 65 and older. Meanwhile, Alaska's become the second state after Montana to activate crisis of care standards at hospitals, which have become overwhelmed with unvaccinated COVID patients. Under the policy, hospitals may now deny treatment to people deemed less likely to survive. This is Alaska's chief medical officer, Dr. Ann Zink.
The strain on our hospital systems is impacting not only people with COVID-19, but people who are there because of a stroke or heart attack or a kid who falls off their bike.
In Florida, Republican Governor Ron DeSantis has appointed an anti-mask vaccine skeptic as his new Surgeon General. As one of his first official acts, Dr. Joseph Ladapo issued an emergency order allowing parents to opt children out of quarantine if they've had close contact at school with someone infected with COVID-19. Ladapo is a proponent of the widely discredited theory of achieving herd immunity through natural infection, which Dr. Anthony Fauci has called nonsense and very dangerous. He's previously appeared at public events with Dr. Stella Emanuel, an evangelical Christian and conspiracy theorist who suggested alien DNA was used in pharmaceuticals and that gynecological problems are caused by sexual visitations by demons. Immigrant rights advocates are blasting the Biden administration over reports it's looking for a contractor to run an immigrant detention facility at Guantanamo Bay's U.S. Naval Base. Homeland Security is reportedly seeking security guards who speak Spanish and Haitian Creole. The DHS told reporters the Biden administration will not send Haitian asylum seekers from the southern border to the facility. Migrants apprehended at sea have been temporarily held at Guantanamo in the past. This comes as deportation flights continue to expel Haitian asylum seekers from the U.S. without due process under Title 42. The Biden administration is challenging a court order which is set to halt the Trump-era policy at the end of the month. Hundreds of Haitians who cross the border have also chosen to leave unsafe conditions and return to Mexico.
I feel disappointed because we crossed over to the U.S. and it wasn't what we expected. They were very mean to us. Just imagine, they treated us like we were trash. They didn't give us food or water. There's no doctors, nothing. A lot of children, pregnant women. Things are really hard for us.
On Capitol Hill, Democratic lawmakers held a news conference Wednesday to denounce the Biden administration's treatment of Haitian refugees at the U.S.-Mexico border. California Congresswoman Maxine Waters cited photos and video from last weekend showing Border Patrol agents on horseback chasing, grabbing, and whipping Haitian asylum seekers.
What the hell are we doing here? What we witness takes us back hundreds of years. What we witnessed was worse than what we witnessed in slavery. Cowboys with their reins again whipping black people, Haitians, into the water where they're scrambling and falling down when all they're trying to do is escape from violence in their country.
In other immigration news, lawyers have still not been able to reach the parents of over 300 children who were ripped apart from their families at the U.S. southern border under Trump's family separation policy. Only 50 children have been reunited by a Biden administration task force charged with bringing the families back together. At the U.N. General Assembly, the Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro demanded an end to sanctions by the U.S. and others, which have devastated the Venezuelan economy and contributed to political and social unrest.
This is financial, monetary, economic persecution, which is systematic, cruel, and criminal. And Venezuela is raising its voice here to denounce it before the people of the world.
President Maduro said Venezuela has been on a path to recovery in 2021 and called for world leaders to build a new world which respects multilateralism and international law. Maduro survived a U.S.-backed coup attempt in 2019. A top advisor to Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky survived an apparent assassination attempt in Kyiv Wednesday. Sergei Shefir was unharmed, but his driver sustained injuries from the shooting. It's not yet known who was behind the attack. This is Ukraine's Minister of Internal Affairs.
But I want to stress that no one will intimidate the team of the President of Ukraine. We will carry on with the reforms we've already started, including ones directed to fight organized crime.
President Zelensky, who was in New York for the U.N. General Assembly at the time of the shooting, said he'll return immediately after his U.N. address in which he denounced the attack. Zelensky also spoke out against Russia's military intervention in eastern Ukraine and urged the U.N. to take more decisive action to combat global crises, likening the international body to a retired superhero. The World Health Organization warned Wednesday air pollution is even more dangerous than previously thought as it slashed its recommended limits for emissions from vehicles and industrial sources. WHO Director General Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus urged nations to take action against dirty air ahead of the COP26 UN climate summit in Glasgow, Scotland.
There is nothing more essential for life than air. And yet, because of air pollution, the simple act of breathing contributes to 7 million deaths a year. Almost everyone around the world is exposed to unhealthy levels of air pollution.
The WHO estimates air pollution accounts for 1 in 8 deaths worldwide each year. On Capitol Hill, bipartisan talks on police reform have fallen apart. The House passed the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act in March, but Democrats have since not been able to secure Republican support to pass accompanying legislation in the Senate. A major sticking point was the use of qualified immunity, which shields police officers from lawsuits. In other policing news, a group of former and active Black women officers in Washington, D.C., filed a class action lawsuit against the Metropolitan Police Department, alleging racial and sexual discrimination. Another New York City prisoner has died. 24-year-old Stefan Kadu on Wednesday became the 12th prisoner to die in a New York City jail since December. He was locked up at the Vernon C. Bain Jail, which is located on a floating barge docked just north of Rikers, where the 11 other prisoners who died in 2021 were also imprisoned. New York City's city council is poised to pass a first-in-the-nation slate of municipal laws protecting app-based food delivery workers. The legislation was first proposed by the labor organization Los Deliveristas Unidos, whose members primarily use electric-powered bicycles to rush restaurant orders around the city. The workers are fighting to secure the tips they earn, the right to access restaurant bathrooms, disability benefits in case of an accident, and better security to prevent bicycle theft. They also say they're misclassified as independent contractors, making them exempt from labor protections like New York's $15 an hour minimum wage. Namibia resumed debate this week on a possible agreement with Germany over the former colonizers' genocide of tens of thousands of Ovaherero and Nama people in the early 1900s. Hundreds protested in front of Namibia's parliament Tuesday against the proposed deal, which includes a payment of more than $1.34 billion paid out over 30 years. This is McHenry Vanani, president of the Popular Democratic Movement, addressing the deal.
For the last 31 years, the Namibian government has received more than $1.1 billion from the German government. The Germans, listen very carefully, the Germans say they are guilty of murdering us. But for this guilt, they are paying the same amount that they have been paying the government for the last 31 years.
And in California, Governor Gavin Newsom has signed a bill giving workers at Amazon and other large warehouses the right to challenge employee productivity quotas and other practices that threaten workplace health and safety. Workers say Amazon's quotas are so strict they often can't stop to use the bathroom. At least two recent studies show Amazon workers suffered serious injuries at nearly twice the rate of other warehouse industry workers in 2020. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
With hunger growing across the globe during the pandemic, the United Nations is holding its first food systems summit today. But the summit is facing fierce criticism for giving corporations an outsized role, framing its agenda with big food names like PepsiCo invited to fireside chats during a pre-summit in Rome. The UN's own experts on food, human rights, and the environment released a statement that, quote, there is a risk the summit will serve the corporate sector more than the people who are essential to ensuring our food systems flourish, such as workers, small producers, women, and indigenous peoples, they said. This comes as UN figures show the pandemic has increased the number of hungry people in the world by as many as 161 million to 811 million, and nearly one in three people worldwide, almost 2.4 billion, lack access to adequate nutrition. Soon we'll be joined by leading food advocates in India and Ethiopia. But we begin with Raj Patel, author of Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World's Food System. His piece just out in the Scientific American is headlined, Agroecology is the Solution to World Hunger. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Raj. It's great to have you with us. If you can start off by talking about just what this World's Food System Summit is all about at the United Nations, and then the fierce attack by hundreds of groups and leading people who are experts in the area, fearful that the corporatization of the summit will only increase hunger in the world.
Thank you, Amy, and thank you for having me. So let's first, as you did, set the scene, recognizing that there is already far too much hunger in the world. You've observed that you know, as many as 811 million people are undernourished and well over 2 billion are food insecure. Right here in the United States, we have 38 million people who are unable to be certain that they're going to be able to put food on the table for their families. And it was bad enough before COVID. There were forces that were pushing up the number of people and the percentage of people around the world who were going hungry even before COVID. And driving that were climate. So climate change has made farming much more precarious, particularly for frontline and low-income communities around the world. So climate, we've got conflict. You'll be talking later on about the U.S. complicity in the engines of conflict and the arms trade around the world. But conflict is driving hunger because it creates displacement. It means that you plant the field and the war tears through your community. You must move on. And harvests are lost and livelihoods are lost. So climate, conflict, and of course, capitalism. Capitalism operates through making sure that you buy low and you sell expensive. That's why in the United States, 7 out of the 10 worst paying jobs are in the food system. But around the world, the deep irony is that the poorest people are usually the people whose hands touch our food. When you've got conflict, climate and capitalism compounded with COVID, you see a really sort of apocalyptic situation. And so there is clearly a need for policymakers to up their game. One of the ways that that can happen is through summits being pulled together where member states say, look, we really need to focus on this. We need to bump this up the policy agenda. And unfortunately, what the UN Food Systems Summit is doing is sort of an end run. It's a very strange summit because rather than having countries come together and say, look, we all agree that we must do this, it's being driven by the UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres. Now, he may have entirely benign intentions because we do, as I say, need to address this problem. In 2016, the world committed itself to having zero hunger, zero undernourishment by 2030. But the rate we're going, we won't have zero. We'll have about a billion people who are undernourished by 2030 if current trends continue. So we do need to do something about this. But the way this summit operated was that Secretary General Guterres appointed in December 2019 the president of the Alliance for the Green Revolution in Africa. Agnes Kalibata, the president of AGRA, was before that she's been president of AGRA since 2014. But before that, she was the Secretary of Agriculture in Rwanda from 2008 to 2014. Now, I mention this because part of her credentials for heading up this summit is that under her tenure, you saw a huge increase in the amount of corn that was produced. Maize output from 2006 to 2019 increased fourfold, and the rice harvests doubled. And that kind of success story coming from Africa was part of the reason why the Secretary General appointed her. But unfortunately, AGRA, this Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa, is driven. It has had mixed results. I mean, even in Rwanda, while the amount of food has gone up, hunger has chronic hunger has increased by 40% over the same period, and so has the number of people who are undernourished. Now, what this means is that we need to look very closely at what AGRA is and how it operates. AGRA was set up by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, in 2006. And the goal there was to bring better agricultural practices to 30 million people across 13 countries in sub-Saharan Africa. $1 billion later, a lot of those dollars coming from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, but also from the United States Agency for International Development and other countries, the results have been fairly grim. So, again, just the sort of Cliff Notes version here, and this comes from excellent research by academics like Tim Wise at Tufts University. But what we've seen is that in the countries where AGRA operates, there's been a 30% increase in the number of people who are suffering hunger. And the agricultural productivity is kind of the same as it was before AGRA began. But what AGRA is a way of locking in a certain kind of way of doing agriculture, where you increase productivity and hope that the money that that generates for certain kinds of farmers trickles down to end hunger. And as we've seen from AGRA's own data, it fails on its own terms.
You said, Raj, that this summit is taking place on the initiative of the UN Secretary General. Could you also talk about the role of the World Economic Forum and how that's informed the content of the summit and who participates?
Well, certainly the ideas that you'll see floating around and the kinds of language that you see floating around the summit bear a striking resemblance to the sorts of ideas that come from the World Economic Forum's sustainability roundtables and sort of corporate-driven missions to try and do something about hunger. And I think that when we hear a little bit more about multi-stakeholderism from Shalmali Gutal in India, we'll really be able to get under the hood of this. But the idea here is that corporations fully understand that if we are to have zero hunger, their bottom lines are going to be targeted. Many of the world's largest food corporations recognize already that they are producing food that is not making the world healthy. A leaked report in the Financial Times earlier on this year showed that I believe it was 60% of Nestlé's food failed to meet even the very basic definition of healthy output. And I think 98% of Nestlé's non-coffee beverages and non-water beverages are considered unhealthy. Corporations know that their number is up. And when they understand that they are going to be regulated and their profits are going to be hit, because how else are we going to be able to end hunger among the poorest but by paying them more, which means corporations will be earning less profit, they want to be on the inside of this regulation game. And they want to control the terms on which policy is set. And so you've got organizations within the sort of UN Food System Summit, in some of the pre-summit meetings, who represent industry. There was a Greenpeace reported yesterday that the International Meat Secretariat, for example, and the International Poultry Council were part of these stakeholders who were around the table talking about livestock and sustainability. And the Meat Council was there saying, well, look, the only way for us to have a really sustainable future is to have more meat production in the global north, because if it goes to the global south, it will be poorly regulated, which is a spectacularly disingenuous argument to be making. But, of course, they can make this argument uninformed by the science of sustainability that says that industrial meat production is one of the drivers of climate change. And we've seen in the United States, industrial meat production was one of the industries that put people, particularly low-income communities and people of color, in the front lines of COVID because of the opening of slaughterhouses in the pandemic. This powerful industry is largely immune to the best practices that we see emerging from the scientific community and the consensus we see emerging from the scientific community around climate change and around poverty. But they're there at this summit because they're considered stakeholders. And that idea of having all the stakeholders around the table together is something that characterizes this summit. That's why you'll hear from this summit that, we invited everyone to come, and those movements outside, we invited them in there. They chose not to be here. But, the sort of philosophy of multi-stakeholderism that was transported from the World Economic Forum to this summit is that you have everyone around the table, murderers and victims, and they try and reach a consensus. And, of course, that's not how we're going to end hunger. And that's one of the reasons why so many organizations are on the outside of the summit protesting its process and trying to moderate the more dangerous effects of its outcomes.
We're talking to Raj Patel, research professor at University of Texas, Austin. His piece in Scientific American is headlined, Agroecology is the Solution to World Hunger. Next up, we'll be continuing with the Raj and go to Ethiopia and India as well, as we talk about hunger growing across the globe. Stay with us.
Come on,
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. With world hunger on the rise amidst the devastating social and economic impact of the COVID-19 pandemic and the climate crisis, we continue to look at concerns that the United Nations' first food systems summit underway today is giving corporations an outsized role framing its agenda. The summit is led by the former Rwandan agricultural minister, Agnes Kalibata, now president of the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa, or AGRA, which critics say promotes industrial agriculture over more sustainable farming. For more, we bring into this conversation Milyon Bilai in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, the general coordinator of the Alliance for Food Sovereignty in Africa. Also with us in Goa, India, is Shyamali Gutel, executive director of Focus on the Global South. Still with us in Austin, Texas, Professor Raj Patel, who serves on the International Panel of Experts on Sustainable Food Systems, author of Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World's Food System. Nermeen?
Milyon Bilai, could you begin by talking about, give us more background on Dr. Agnes Kalibata and her record, the record of the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa, of which she's the head, and why you think she was appointed the UN Special Envoy for this food summit?
Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity. Thanks for the lovely music. And I love Gigi quite a lot. I think I would love to focus on the institution rather than on the individual. Maybe they have selected her because she's a woman, she's a black woman, she's an African woman, as a form of representing this as a global agenda. Maybe, you know, in terms of image, she fits that bill. But the Alliance for Green Revolution in Africa has 13 board members, 13, and 8 of them are outside, from outside Africa, and it's registered in the U.S. And Rockefeller Foundation, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, some companies are in the board of AGRA. So this is an outside controlled institution. And this shows that, you know, the corporate world wanted to control this event. It's very sad because discussion around the food system is very much critical because there is a health crisis, there's a nutrition crisis, hunger crisis, environmental crisis, cultural crisis, and human rights crisis. We're in a crisis. And the majority of this crisis is because of the food system that we have. So we need transition, the right kind of transition. Therefore, the institution that she represents, even if it's the name says, the Alliance for Green Revolution in Africa. You know, we know what Green Revolution has done in India. And Shyamali can tell us about that. You know, it has destroyed people's life, people's culture, seed, the environment, and has created, you know, a huge burden of disease. And malnutrition is still there. And as Raj said, it has failed in Africa. It has been tried for 13 years, and it has failed. Now we have seen the recommendation from Africa for the UNFSS for transition. It's all about green ecology, green revolution. So yeah, this is very sad. You know, it's a wasted chance, I would like to say.
So, Shyamali Gutel, you're in Goa, India. as you look at the Food System Summit from there. This segment is larger than the Food System Summit. It's about the growing hunger in the world. But can you talk about that approach? You've been a fierce critic. You've been tweeting a lot about what's happening and how it's determining what's happening in the world and what you see needs to happen.
Thank you, Amy. Can you hear me?
We hear you perfectly.
Okay. Well, yes, there is growing hunger in the world, and there is growing inequality and growing poverty and unemployment. And all this is not because there isn't enough food being produced in the world. A majority of the world's food is produced by, you know, small-scale food producers who are producing this food on just about a quarter of the world's territories. 80% of the world's territories and resources are actually captured by larger businesses and corporations. And there's a lot of food procurement, production, provision that goes undocumented. But when we talk about the crises in the food systems, it's really interesting that the mainstream discourse isn't looking at the crisis of the global food system, which is the industrialized, corporate-controlled food system, which has been responsible, you know, for many of the multiple crises that we're facing now, with, you know, the hunger, the unemployment, the malnutrition, the climate change crisis, the industrial contamination, and so on. So, you know, in the last 10 to 15 years, with crisis after crisis coming out, and the food price crisis more than 10 years ago, and the financial crisis, which was also there in 2009, 2010. Since then, it's become really increasingly clear to the world's people that this industrialized, globalized, corporate-led food system is failing us. It has failed. It's not going to do anything better. And to keep pouring, you know, money into it and resources into it is dangerous. But how, unfortunately, or rather maybe this has been the design, so it's not a question of luck or fortune, more and more privatization has been happening across the South. It was already happening in the North countries. It's been happening more and more in the South, including key aspects of food provision. Now, food has a tremendous public purpose. The right to food is dependent on the right realization of numerous other rights. Similarly, the violation of other rights, you know, also affects the right to food. And food as a holistic, how we say, it's not a thing, you know, it's a whole dimension of, in and of itself. Control over the different aspects of food are extremely important for those who want to continue to make profits. And this has been one of the big tragedies of privatization and liberalization and deregulation and then re-regulation for corporations that we have seen over the last 15 or 20 years. And, you know, the COVID-19 pandemic showed who feeds the world, who looked after the world. It wasn't the industrialized, globalized food system. It were local producers. It was food sovereignty movements. It was unions. It was mutual help groups, community kitchens, community-shared agriculture and fisheries. This is what helped. This is what fed the world during COVID. And, you know, the way we see it, my own organization and the group that we're very closely aligned with in the Civil Society and Indigenous Peoples Mechanism, and we have a larger group of social movements called the Liaison Group of the Autonomous Peoples Response to the UN Food System Summit. You know, for us, it's very clear that this food system summit has been deliberately designed and pushed forward the way it is to allow corporations to secure control, not only over food and food systems, but equally important over the governance of food systems. And that's a very important issue, which I hope I'll be able to speak further on in this program. Why don't I stop here for the moment?
Well, Shalmali, as Million mentioned, one of the examples that's touted most in favor of industrial agriculture is, of course, the experience of the Green Revolution in India. This was first introduced in 1965. and its advocates say, led substantially to a reduction in hunger as well as malnutrition. Could you explain why you're critical of this approach and what's happened in recent decades following its initial purported success?
Well, yes, initially, the Green Revolution did boost production. And there was, yes, there were, you know, overflowing granaries. And yes, it did indeed address the hunger or lack of food problem at that time. But what it also did was introduce and convert Indian agriculture into chemically intensive monocultures. And these chemically intensive monocultures, initially, they may have come, you know, through public subsidies and supports. I mean, the inputs and the inputs for those production. But over the decades, as that those supports and subsidies started to, you know, started to dry out, small-scale farmers, family farmers, even middle-scale, you know, a middle-scale farmer in India would be, I think in hectares, not in acres, so it would be, you know, three to four hectares would be a small-scale farmer. A middle-scale farmer would be, say, maximum 10 to 15 hectares. They started finding themselves in increased debt traps, because one of the things that happened with these with intensive use of chemicals is your soil gets contaminated, and it will not keep producing. And in order to make your soil produce and make your farms produce, you're going to pump more and more chemicals into it. And it's a vicious cycle of destruction of the very territory from which you would grow your food. And so what we saw, that destruction triggered the environmental and a crisis of production, but attendant to that, a tremendous social crisis. So farmers who were not able to meet their debt payments for the inputs that they had bought, purchased, when their seeds failed, they had to buy more seeds, so they got more into debt. They put their land into mortgage, and we saw a distress migration of people away from the rural areas into the urban areas. And so more and more hands that were producing the food left the land, and they left that kind of production and started moving into other types of production. Now, many of them stayed in the food world. I mean, as Raj said earlier, the hands that touch our food, most of the hands that touch our food do come from food-producing families, but they're doing different jobs now. You know, they're working in construction labor or delivery or food vending, you know, local vending. But a lot of, and this is not a case only in India. This is a case throughout Asia. We're going through a very severe agrarian crisis across Asia, where industrialized, monoculture-oriented, intensive, chemically intensive agriculture has created has created economic and social crises. So in India, for example, I think the world is very familiar with the farmer suicides that have happened in India. These suicides are the highest where farmer debt is the highest, and farmer debt is the highest, of course, where farmers have been forced to borrow for seeds, for equipment, for chemicals. And we must also see this side by side with the other crisis that India was going through, and which the inability and the failure of the Indian state to ensure strong social protection systems. Because one may be in debt, a family may be in debt, and be using all its, you know, using whatever income that it has to pay off its debt. But if you don't have good public health systems, if you don't have good social security and social protection system, you don't have a decent education system, you don't have transportation, clean water, if all these are either being disinvested by the public exchequer and or being privatized, most rural communities in India and in many parts of Asia are one major illness away from complete ruin, because they will have to pay huge, you know, huge healthcare bills if they want to get any decent healthcare. So, you know, it's these are processes that are going together. The Green Revolution at one hand, and the, you know, the social and economic crisis, and then which were closely related to the environmental contamination and crisis it created, accompanied by a absence and then, you know, of sufficient public investment being going to social, important key social and even financial sectors.
We only have a few more minutes to go at this moment, but we are going to continue this discussion, of course, on Democracy Now. But I wanted to go back to Million Bilei, who is in the capital of Ethiopia, in Addis. If you could talk about why you see it's critical to frame the hunger issue in a human rights framework and what that would mean. What has to happen now? Use the example of your own country, Ethiopia, Million.
Yeah. I think the responsibility of feeding the people is from government. Government are responsible to feed the people. For that, they have to have the right policy, the right kind of agricultural policy. If you follow the Green Revolution agenda and put farmers in debt and contaminate the soil, and also, you know, in terms of productivity and also the diversity of the seeds, you know, there's an increased diversity. Through time, you are putting your population, the farmer population, which is over 80% in Ethiopia, into unsustainability. You know, you are trapping them into the future, which is not sustainable at all. So they have to have the right to choose what kind of agriculture they want. They have the right to choose what kind of seed that they want to plant. And the kind of, you know, it has broken the social fabric of the society somehow, the kind of agriculture that's happening. And it has even damaged the relationship between the government and the people, because the government has to force the people to accept high-yielding varieties and artificial fertilizers and pesticides and a certain way of farming and reorienting the whole agriculture into market. You know, all that puts people into a situation where they will be much more poorer than before. So they are not getting better. And it's a responsibility of the government that, you know, to keep the country and the people in the path of sustainability, not in the path of dependence. And when the people have a problem because of the environment and social and political and whatever, it's a government's responsibility to provide food, to make food accessible, to ensure that that food is healthy and nutritious, and to ensure that that food is culturally appropriate, and to protect them from the vagaries of trade. So that's what we mean by the right to food and the human rights at the center of food production. And we feel that agroecology ticks all that. It produces more food, healthy food, nutritious food, without impacting the environment, even improving the environment, and culturally appropriate food, and the right to food is at the center of agroecology. That's what we want to promote.
Well, Raj Patel, we'd like to end with you. One of the striking things that you point out in your Scientific American article, Agroecology is the Solution to World Hunger, which is what Million was saying as well, is that over the past decade, food production has outstripped demand. There's more food per person than there ever was. And the problem with food distribution is not so much its quantity, but the fact that it's distributed in an unequal way. Could you explain how the practice of agroecology, which you've witnessed yourself in Malawi and elsewhere, how this practice could also ensure more equitable access and distribution?
Thank you so much. And very briefly, agroecology is a science, it's a set of practices, and it is a social movement to be able to transform the way that we not just grow food, but regulate it and share it and make sure that everyone has it and that it exists within the broader economy that Charmelle Million were talking about just now. Agroecology is a way not only of identifying that there are amazing synergies between different kinds of crops that don't rely on the industrial chemical intensive agriculture that Shalmali was talking about, but also that we need social synergies. We need ways of recognizing and supporting our food production around the world in ways that redirect subsidies away from chemically intensive agriculture and the health subsidies and the environmental costs of industrial agriculture, and instead aims big. And that means really, the heart of agroecology is a leveling of inequalities in power. I mean, hunger today is gendered. 10% more women around the world are hungry than men. We see, obviously, inequalities in hunger in terms of race globally, in terms of colonialism and its histories. But if we are to be serious about taking agroecology to scale, we have to tackle inequalities in power. And I think that's what one of the worries about this food system summit is, that it is concentrating power in governance mechanisms that are entirely unaccountable. And what agroecology offers is a circular and solidarity economy that is absolutely about sort of leveling inequalities in power, so that we not only are able to coax more from the soil, but also return more to it and make sure that everyone gets to eat healthily.
We want to thank you all for being with us. And again, this is a conversation, of course, we're going to continue to have. I want to thank Raj Patel, who's speaking to us from the University of Texas, Austin. Among his books, Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World's Food System. His latest book is called Simply Inflamed. We also want to thank Million Bilai, Alliance for Food Sovereignty in Africa is his group, speaking to us from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. And Shalmali Gutel, who is with Focus on the Global South, Executive Director. She is in Goa, India. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, the United States of War. We look at the new military partnership between the United States, Australia, and Britain. Is the U.S. provoking a Cold War with China? Stay with us.
When you hide
Wrong Time Capsule by Deerhoof. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. The Australian Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, held meetings with U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi Wednesday to discuss plans for AUKUS. That's the new military trilateral partnership between the United States, Australia, and Britain. The nations announced the new alliance last week, saying it was needed to counter China's growing power in the Indo-Pacific region. As part of the agreement, the United States has agreed to help Australia build a fleet of nuclear-powered submarines. This led Australia to cancel its submarine deal with France. They were building non-nuclear-powered submarines for Australia, and this has sparked a major diplomatic rift. Far less attention, though, has been paid to another aspect of the AUKUS partnership, how it'll help the United States increase its military presence in Australia, where the U.S. already has at least 7 military installations. This is Australia's Defense Minister Peter Dutton speaking last week.
I'm proud to announce that Australia and the United States will be significantly enhancing our force posture cooperation, increasing interoperability and deepening alliance activities in the Indo-Pacific. This will include greater air cooperation through rotational deployments of all types of U.S. military aircraft to Australia.
During the same news conference, the U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin focused part of his remarks on China.
We spoke in detail about China's destabilizing activities and Beijing's efforts to coerce and intimidate other countries, contrary to established rules and norms. And while we seek a constructive, results-oriented relationship with the PRC, we will remain clear-eyed in our view of Beijing's efforts to undermine the established international order.
China has denounced the new U.S.-Australia-Britain alliance, saying the countries are, quote, severely damaging regional peace and stability, intensifying an arms race, and damaging international nuclear nonproliferation efforts. For more, we go to Oakland, California, to speak to David Vine, professor of anthropology at American University, who tracks U.S. military bases overseas. He's just written a new article for Responsible Statecraft titled, Not Just About Subs, AUKUS Expands U.S. Military Footprint in Australia, Too. His recent book, The United States of War, A Global History of America's Endless Conflicts from Columbus to the Islamic State. So, David Vine, as Biden pulls U.S. troops out of Afghanistan, is he ramping up a Cold War with China? And one of the first examples we see of this, multi-billion-dollar deal with Australia to sell them nuclear-powered submarines. If you can talk about what this all means.
First, it's a pleasure to be with you, and Nermeen, thank you so much for having me. It is a tremendously disturbing, dangerous, reckless, and ultimately racist announcement and alliance that the three governments have announced. In answer to your question about whether this is a new Cold War, I think this announcement of this triple alliance does ultimately is an announcement of a near formal declaration of a new Cold War that leads us. Can lead us down a path toward a war that could be not only cold, but it really should be unthinkably a hot, possibly nuclear war between the two most powerful nations on Earth, China and the United States. Most of the focus has been on the sub deal, which has very disturbing elements, but I'm glad you are calling attention to the military buildup that the deal represents. I think it is helpful for people in the United States in particular to think, how would we feel if China last week had announced that it was entering an alliance with Russia and Cuba to build up military bases and military forces, air, naval, and land forces in Cuba, to also be engaged in weapons development, including hypersonic weapons development and electromagnetic weapons development, to engage in increased cyber intelligence gathering, spying, and space activities with Cuba, to also have a mining deal in place, and to be building nuclear-powered submarines that involve the transfer of weapons grade, that is, nuclear weapons grade, highly enriched uranium, to Cuba. How would we feel if the shoe was on the other foot, if we were if faced with this kind of an alliance in our backyard? That is what the United States announced last week with Australia and the UK, that they are building up an already massive U.S. military presence in China's backyard with additional bases, forces, weapons development, spy capabilities, and the transfer of nuclear weapons technology to a non-nuclear power that really undermines the nuclear nonproliferation regime, meaning it sets us back in our efforts to abolish nuclear weapons on Earth.
Well, David, let's go to President Biden speaking Tuesday at the United Nations, where he explicitly said the U.S. is not seeking a new Cold War.
We'll stand up for our allies and our friends and oppose attempts by stronger countries to dominate weaker ones, whether through changes to territory by force, economic coercion, technical exploitation, or disinformation. But we're not seeking, say it again, we are not seeking a new Cold War or a world divided into rigid blocks.
So, David, could you respond to what Biden said and also the fact that he seems now to be fulfilling the promise or initiative that Obama had suggested 12 years ago, which is this idea of U.S. foreign policy pivoting to Asia?
Yeah, I'm a bit tired of Biden's words. He said some nice words at the U.N. about diplomacy, about humanitarian aid, about not wanting a new Cold War with China. But his actions are very different. And you know, for those of us like myself who supported his withdrawal from Afghanistan is absolutely the right thing to do, and a withdrawal that was long overdue. He's turning his back on diplomacy with this announcement. This is far more significant than, you know, any words he uttered at the UN about diplomacy and not wanting a new Cold War. That is what this represents. He is aligning these three powers against China. And I think we have to, again, ask, you know, how do we expect Chinese leaders to respond? This really risks setting off an increased arms race. And you know, we shouldn't be surprised if China looks to line up an alliance of its own, again, resembling the Cold War. And in so many ways, this is really Cold War era thinking, and in many ways, 19th century thinking. And I really hope and think the Biden administration can be much better than that. We are in no position to be building, to be spending any time, any energy, building military alliances at this moment when we have such grave security threats facing us, from global warming to global pandemics to hunger to inequality, global poverty. Those are the kinds of alliances we should be building. And those are the kinds of alliances that the United States can be building. I think really we have a choice now. We have a choice whether we want to firmly and finally turn our backs on war and engage in diplomacy and a different kind of alliance building focused on the real security threats facing us, or whether we want to firmly and finally commit to a new Cold War with China that could be catastrophically damaging to the world. I mean, it could make the catastrophe of the last 20 years of war, where by my estimate, 4.5 million people died in the U.S.-led wars, where we spent $8 trillion, trillion with a T, on war. You know, this new Cold War will strip even more funds from the needs that are actually facing us and plow more money into the military-industrial congressional complex. This is the choice we're facing.
So, David Vine, you have this amazing map in your new piece for the Quincy Institute, highlighting every country where the U.S. has an overseas military base, around 800 U.S. bases, including 80 in South Korea, 119 in Japan. Take us on a tour in this last minute we have, and to also talk about Africa.
Sure. But by our estimate, there are now about 750 U.S. military bases abroad in 80 countries and colonies. 750. This is more than any other country in the world. And in fact, it's probably three times the number of all the other countries in the world combined. Probably the largest collection of foreign military bases in world history. And as you mentioned, there are seven bases in Australia. In total, in the Asia-Pacific region, the United States easily has almost 300 foreign military bases surrounding China already, and now they're calling for an increased buildup. There's been a growing collection of U.S. military bases in Africa, as you mentioned, since around the early days after the attacks of 9/11. And it's a collection of bases that touches every continent except Antarctica. There is no reason to be building new military bases in Australia or any part of the world. The Biden administration needs to move in the other direction, and it was moving in that direction by closing bases and withdrawing troops from Afghanistan. It should be building on that by closing more bases that are undermining U.S. and global security, but it's not. And again, we face a choice between a path toward a permanent Cold War and continued endless war, or diplomacy and peace building.
We have to leave it there. David Vine, author of The United States of War. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe.